I'm also chairing the Drug Policy Pharmacy Services Committee along with Maggie Russell here. Can you all hear me? You can? It's my voice and I don't know. That's not working, is it? Does it? Okay, I'm going to try and speak up a little bit more so.
It's on? Okay, it's on. You can hear it click now? Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Melissa.
Lovely.
Thank you. So I'm going to try and keep this shorter so that I don't cut into my colleagues' time here. This is actually a part of our ongoing research on global access to medications. And so very quickly, drugs or pharmaceuticals are a special kind of public good, primarily because they have a significant role in promoting public health. However, they're also very time-consuming in terms of manufacturing, research, and development. They're risky with all their side effects and expensive. When patenting systems came about, there was this issue of monopoly abuse, and this has been considered years ago. It was considered in Japan, Switzerland, and European countries. In the United States, patenting has always fluctuated from one end to the other in terms of political climate. Initially, it was a very pro-patent climate, which then went down, on the other hand, to strong anti-patent feelings with the economic depression. And then it has again come back to increasing patent life from 17 to 20 years. So again, we're in a pro-patenting era. One of the most, contentious issues has been patent extensions. This has been very, very extensively studied. Patent extensions run into issues of antitrust, which is basically the opposite of monopolization. If most of you remember, the government broke up AT&T several years ago because of monopoly power. And this is parallel to what patents would end up doing. There is significant potential for abuse there in terms of increasing prices and restricting access. There are also instances where pharmaceutical brand name manufacturers have blocked generics from entering into the market and then have formed new formulations or combination medications to prolong patent life from their awarded patent life of 20 years. For example, Claritin, which was manufactured by Schering Plough, was then changed to Clarinex, which is based upon a patent of a metabolite of Claritin when it ended, when it neared the end of its patent cycle or patent life. And then there are instances of changes in dosing from once a day to twice a day just to extend the patent life. So this is sort of a funny example of what a drug company might do. So they take a goose, and he says, we've modified it significantly since our patent expired. So we want a new patent, and it's the moose that lays the golden eggs. Isn't that wonderful? And they also say, we spent 4 years and $90 million on the television ads for the moose that laid the golden eggs. So anyways, one of the key questions that the pharmaceutical industry brings up, and this is significant because they talk about innovation, and some people might say that they might hold this over us, saying if you don't give us the patents and if you don't give us the power of exclusivity, then we might not be able to innovate. Now, this may be true to a certain extent because it does. There is a situation of avoiding exclusivity to the innovator. There is a pattern of avoiding them. But at the same time, if you look in the past couple of years, Marcia Angel has written a wonderful book, The Truth About Drug Companies. And in this book, it said that between 1998 and 2002, there were 415 drugs that were approved in the United States. Excuse me. Of which only 32% or 133 were new molecular entities, and the remaining 68% were actually variations of old drugs. Only 14% of these new molecular entities or these whole things were deemed by the FDA to have significant therapeutic advances. Now take that and place it against a background of prescription drug spending of $250 billion, which was in 2005 and then rose up to $268 billion in 2007 without any significant innovation or without any significant future pipelines. And so some of the key questions that arise out of this are, does exclusivity guarantee innovation? Can we be assured? Can the pharmaceutical industry provide us a certain amount of assurance that if we award them a huge number of patents or if we increase their patent lives, they would actually innovate and then provide us with new drugs that are therapeutically very different from the ones that are already on the market? I honestly don't know the answer for that, and I don't know if the pharmaceutical industry would be willing to provide such a guarantee. There are increased prices on drugs for Americans as well as developing countries. In 2001, and this is horrific because the brand name AIDS drugs were sold to poor African nations for about $10,000 per patient per year, where average income levels were only less than $5 a day. So this is another little cartoon that I thought was interesting, where the scientist is saying, do a double-blind test, give the new drug to rich patients and a placebo to the poor. No sense getting their hopes up. They couldn't afford it even if it works. I mean, it's funny, but it's sad at the same time, you know? Anyways, I'm just trying to look at these issues of global drug access because it's a global economy. There's this little cartoon was in a Kenyan newspaper, and the guy looks at it and says, this is great news. The news is government will increase access to ARVs to HIV-positive patients. So he goes and tells his wife, now we can sell our ARVs to access food. And this tells you a lot. I mean, these cartoons, they really do. There are significant barriers and there are significant points towards access globally, both to developed as well as developing countries. In terms of developing countries, there's two issues primarily that are going on. First is external, basically. For those countries that don't have manufacturing capabilities or a pharmaceutical industry, they have to trade with other countries to procure pharmaceuticals, or they have to trade with the other pharmaceutical manufacturers. So that's an external issue, which is regulated by the World Trade Organization through their trade agreements. The internal issue is basically, once you've procured the drugs, what do you do with them? It all depends on your drug distribution systems, public health initiatives, the government policies towards providing and improving access for the poorer population, and then NGO initiatives. Circumventing patents just refers to basically how do you get about if you don't want to pay the $10,000 per day, as I said, for the African nations. In the World Trade Organization, in its trade-related intellectual and property agreement, or was that systems? TRIPS. Anyways, in January 1st, 1995, talked about these issues. There are certain mechanisms that are in place, and the next slide is actually much more clearer. These are the flexibilities, as they like to call it, built into the TRIPS agreement in the interests of health. So if you look at it, there's Articles 6, 38, and 31 that address these. So there's compulsory licensing, parallel imports, BOLA exception, experimental use, and then health sector participation, and you can read that. So the ones that mine and Dr. Salmon's research really focused on was compulsory licensing, primarily because it's been so much in the media lately. It's basically authorizing a third party to make, use, or sell a patented invention without the patent holder's consent. So it's basically just breaking patents. Our suggestion is basically to ideally try and obtain voluntary licenses. Oftentimes, if a pharmaceutical manufacturer, a brand name manufacturer, sees that they are not going to make a lot of money in the country, they will, if asked for and if you really push for it, they might actually give a voluntary license. It's not very common, it's not very often done, but it is a possibility. However, in the case of a national emergency or in the case where you have a lot of people who have the disease and can't afford it, then it would be ideal to actually issue a compulsory license. But this requires paying reasonable royalties. Now, the reasonableness of the royalties is actually not defined. So compulsory licensing, just to provide you with an overview, is not a new phenomenon, even though it just seems like it's very recent. It was actually introduced as early as 1790 in the U.S. Senate. It's been thought about for quite a while now. The specific provisions may vary between the member nations of the WTO. However, the most important thing to keep in mind is basically, if the brand name manufacturers indulge in undesirable behavior, such as blocking generics in another host country, or basically if there's a national emergency or some sort of government infringement, compulsory licensing can be invoked. However, our contention is that compulsory licenses actually favor developed countries because these countries already have strong patenting systems in place. There is exertion of power to a certain extent and significant lobbying by the pharmaceutical industry, and Dr. Salmon's slides just before me illustrated some of that. Some of the examples are, as you can see in Brazil, I'm just going to move on. But it basically means that Brazil did not obtain a lot of U.S. patents, whereas the U.S. has multiple patents in Brazil. So that's actually what it means. Invoking compulsory licensing, if you read media and newspapers, newsletters, they just fluctuate very widely in their observations. It seems like they're very easy to invoke, that every second, third developing country is just running about trying to get these compulsory licensing things done. In actuality, developing countries are very, very hesitant to invoke them. There are significant economic differences between developed and developing or underdeveloped countries, and application of a blanket compulsory licensing provision does very little to ensure increased access and health equity. First of all, developing countries fear the U.S. trade representative watch list with political economic repercussions. For example, Thailand did not actually invoke a compulsory license for AZT because it was under pressure from the USTR. And however, later it broke patents on Abbott's Caltrate, but then Abbott refused to market any new drugs in the country. If you look at U.S. Trade Law Special 301, I'm just going to let you read that. It basically provides a means of retaliation against countries that can break patents. That's pretty much what it ends up meaning, because it's very, very vague if you look at it. Okay. So this is just basically comparing how many countries have actually issued and invoked compulsory licenses. And there are several more examples, but I've just picked the ones that would compare developed versus developing, and then the least developed countries. And the point to note here is in the middle and low income, which is developing and least developed countries, almost all the compulsory licenses were issued for HIV/AIDS drugs. Whereas for the developed countries, in the U.S., a compulsory license was issued for Cipro for the anthrax scare. In Canada, it was for Tamiflu. In Germany, it's for Roche's bid for a compulsory license of Chiron's HIV blood screening patent. And then just to make a little bit of a point about national emergencies, they can be declared by a World Trade Organization member to invoke and issue compulsory licenses. However, bear in mind that there is no quantitative definition of what a national emergency constitutes. So how many people infected with the disease, what's the incidence, the prevalence, countries are free to make up their own criterion for that. It is often thought of as the only provision to invoke compulsory licenses, but if you read the flexibilities, there are many other reasons why compulsory licenses can actually be invoked. It's not necessary to actually declare a national emergency. It should only be used if there is a public health crisis going on. So with that said, I'm going to turn this around to Dr. Salmon, who's going to discuss compulsory licenses. Are you going to come around? Or...
These are mechanisms that basically are ongoing in the debate. When developing nations challenge pharmaceutical companies for drugs that they deem that they need, there are mechanisms that you can put in place that would would basically allow for the negotiations to be a little less contentious. The situation in Thailand ended up coming out to be, with Abbott's atavistic reaction, problematic. Abbott had 8 drugs that were being considered by the Thai FDA that they withdrew. Merck and Sanofi of Venice, which had 2 other drugs that they put on compulsory licensing, did not take those kinds of actions. Counterfeit drugs are a major issue in most countries of the world, including the United States, and that counterfeit, if you're an industry person, is anything that's made and it's not branded. But the real issue is the fake drugs, drugs that have no active ingredient or are deleterious, or people take them with the idea that they're going to be helpful. Standardization uniformity is a real big issue with how do you handle these things, because the generic industry has to be reviewed for quality and the competency of many FDAs around the world, and the enforcement issues and things like that for good manufacturing processes is really an issue. You know, I would sense that most people in public health circles say that patents are one thing, but for VISTA, right? If somebody steals your VISTA or your copy of Steven Spielberg's movies or something like that, you know, that it's sad and it's stealing or something like that. But drugs are really public goods. And, you know, you can live without VISTA, but you can't live without drugs. And whether we come around to a discussion in World Trade Organizations that patents should be changed from 20 years for public goods, food substances and drugs and things like that. And then again, we're talking about the pricing of drugs being 25% or 30%. Profit. Amgen made 40% profit a couple years ago. The AIDS drug company, blanking the name, that Donald Rumsfeld was head of for a while. Again, a 40% profit or so. So if we're talking about the cost of actually making the drug, it's a whole different question around an inability to pay. And then least developed countries, you know, do we look at a public health concern in recognizing that governments around the world with people, citizens that are making $2 or $5 a day, being able to go ahead and afford drugs, this is a real major issue. We're done with this now, but this is basically one of Megda's cartoons again that she puts in. All right, thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you. Our last presenter, who's going to talk about how the pharmaceutical industry exploits one aspect of marketing, is Melissa Bartik, who's a practicing physician in Boston, and she wants to have enough time for her presentation, so she's asked me to cut her description short, but she's super active in all kinds of ways, including the Ban the Bags campaign and other things about infant formula and how the pharmaceutical industry works on that. I love these cartoons.
Thank you, Maggie, and thanks for having this session.